Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
The myth is real. The dream is alive. Fight Island is official. It is official. This is no longer a state of mind. It's an actual place on the map. And here is Dana White to break it all down.
Where is Fight Island?
Well, now it's out. It's been leaked.
It's
Yas Island in Abu Dhabi.
Oh my gosh, it's breaking news on Facebook. I love you. I was all prepared to like smack you down, no t-shirt for you, because I thought you'd refuse to answer that question.
Yas Island, Abu Dhabi.
Pretty exciting stuff. Yas Island, Abu Dhabi is now Fight Island. So what started out as a crazy what if is actually now real. You know, when that idea first surfaced, everybody thought that was some kind of a joke. I mean, be honest. You did, right? We all did. It sounded too crazy to be real. Like securing an island just so people can fight on it. An island only for fighting. I mean, what do you call an island that is only for fighting? Hammer fist isle, chokehold sandbar, face punch key. I mean, on the surface, the idea sounded completely insane. Really surreal. Like something out of a Bond film, or a cartoon, or a video game. Again, securing an island and building it out during a global pandemic sounded bat bleep crazy. Or in the very least, the kind of thing that gets talked about but never actually gets finished. But it is real. And apparently it's done. It is Fight Island. An island where fighters go to, you know, fight. An island where fighters go to beat and choke the crap out of each other. And as Dana said on the show last week, the first card is going to be UFC 251, and it's going to be on July 11th. It's a hell of a card, and it features not one, not two, but three belts on the line. Peter Yan's going to take on Jose Aldo for the Bantamweight Championship. Alex Volkanovski and Max Holloway face each other again in a rematch for the featherweight title, and then you've got your headliner, Kamaru Usman and Gilbert Burns for the welterweight belt. Is that any good? Sure as hell is. That's an awesome card. An awesome card. But then again, it had to be. There's no way you roll out something called Fight Island and then have a couple of scrubs show up or a couple of ham and eggers show up for a slap fight. You take that big of a swing, it better be a damn good show. Fight Island has to be an event. You need stars. You need champions. You need belts. You need title fights. And that's what we're going to get. UFC 251 is going to be the first of four cards held on Fight Island. But the real star of UFC 251 might not be the fighters. It might be the island itself. Yeah, I admit, I'm fascinated by the island. Because the island includes an arena, a hotel, a training facility, places to eat, and there's going to be a safety zone of 10 square miles where the only people allowed in are fighters, coaches, UFC staff, and limited essential personnel. And as if Fight Island could not get any more Fight Island, there's also going to be a training octagon right on the beach. Like, what's better than that? And all of this is not just for show. It is a necessity because the UFC needed to be able to host fights with international fighters. You can't just hole up in Florida or Nevada and only have fights with U.S.-based fighters. They had to expand the pool. Ask Dana.
We're literally just going to Yas Island right now to pull off these fights because the hardest thing to do right now is to get people into the country from other parts of the world. And we are a true global business. We're the only ones that are pulling off live sports right now. And if I continue to do fights in the United States, I'm going to burn out all my American talent. So now we got Yas Island ready to go. It's set up.
Yas Island, ready to go, all set up. And all you weenies out there, you would have seen this global pandemic, the restrictions on international travel. You would have seen that and used it as a reason to shut it down and take the summer off. Not Dana, not the UFC. They're pushing on. They're taking over islands. They're creating 10-mile safety zones, and they're building cages on the beach. Not only is it set up, not only is it ready to go, not only will there be a fight, multiple fights, starting in 31 days, the UFC is actually already selling merch off the island. And I'm not talking about some hastily designed t-shirt that looks like you sell out of the back of your car, like that crap that Hawk is hawking. Just kidding, Adam. Ooh, that woke your ass up, didn't it? Wake up, Hawk! Hawk's gear is nice. Buy it. Did you wake your ass up, Hawk? I'm talking... He's like, I'm in it. You are now. I'm not talking about the kind of stuff you sell out of the back of your car. I'm talking about officially branded Fight Island gear with a specific logo and a color scheme and a broad range of styles. Like, I'm checking out their store. They've already got 12 different Fight Island t-shirt designs. There are 3 different sweatshirts, 5 different hats, including a bucket cap. There are branded water bottles, frisbees, tote bags, face masks, mugs, beach towels, board shorts. I repeat, Fight Island board shorts. They've got a Fight Island branded board short in beer koozies. Pretty impressive. Like, they're leaning into it, and they're leaning in hard. They're not just scrambling and throwing together some card in some random spot because they have to get some fights together or keep their international fighters busy. They're building this out to be a full-blown thing. They're capitalizing on it. Fight Island is not a joke. It's a bleeping brand onto itself. You know, adapt or die. Pivot or get run down. This is what all great businesses do. You're presented with a challenge. You figure out a way to make it an opportunity. I mean, not to put too fine of a point on this, but Major League Baseball, for instance, can't get a damn schedule together. And the USC is off securing islands, building infrastructure, and developing fashion lines. Scoreboard, Rob Manfred. Go ahead, look up at it. Dana White's getting bleeped down, done. While Manfred in Major League Baseball just keeps stepping in their own bleep. This guy's got an island and a hotel and restaurants and cages on the beach and a full line of merch. And fights. Lots of fights. We are joined by Alex Mack. Alex, it is so good to have you on the program. In fact, back in the day, Alex, I used to love it. When you would tweet this show, it is good to get caught up. How are you and how is life for you right now, Alex?
Thanks for having me on. Yeah, big listener for a while. Quite the introduction. I'm a little starstruck. Thank you.
My man, you've had a really nice career. You earned all of that. Listen, what has the offseason been like for you and everybody around you?
It's been a tough year for, I think, the planet. So I can't really complain all that much for being a football player and having to find a place to work out that's not like the gym I want. It's been a tough year. I had to cancel my wedding and move it to next year. So that was disappointing. But if that's the worst thing that happens to me, like, I am just fine.
Alex Mack is joining us. All right, so what about those two things you just mentioned? You live in Hermosa Beach, so when the lockdown started, the gyms were closed. What did you have for workout equipment at that time? How did you go about working out in the early days?
Right as it started to happen and like the pain was on the writing was on the wall, started working with a local gym, try to figure out what I can borrow, take, buy, move, you know, whatever I could do to get the stuff as quickly as possible. And I think I was a little ahead of the curve because able to get with a local gym company out here, got a big shipment of the essentials and then slowly added to that. So moved the car to the street. And now my garage is where I have to work out. And so that got me through everything pretty good. We have a rookie who just now has gotten his squat rack, which is not exactly what you want for your off-season training.
No, right? But then again, there was that run. Once people needed what they needed, it was tough to get things. But you being the vet, you got out there early. You mentioned the wedding. Now, the initial plan was for you and your fiance, Rachel, to get married in Ireland, then go on a honeymoon in Sri Lanka and Maldives. Obviously, that's not going to happen. What have you gone or how have you gone about making do in the meantime? Aside from getting your workouts in, what have you been doing?
A lot of time spending just at home. I found out that I'm quite an accomplished homebody. So So I'm pretty okay with that. It was tough for us. We had a lot of friends and family support us, and so we're just going to move it next year and hopefully have a rocking party when everything calms down.
Hey, listen, whether you're working from home or working on your fitness, you want to make sure that what you're listening to is what you're listening to, not what your roommates or neighbors or significant others are listening to. Everybody needs a great pair of wireless earbuds, but before you go dropping hundreds of bucks on a pair, you need to check out the wireless earbuds from Raycon. Now, you already know Raycon earbuds start at about half the price of any other premium wireless earbuds on the market. And they sound just as amazing as the other top audio brands that you know. Now, check this. Their newest model, the Everyday E25 earbuds, are the best ones to date. 6 hours of playtime, seamless Bluetooth pairing, more bass, and a more compact design that gives you a nice noise-isolating fit. Raycon's wireless earbuds are so comfortable, they're perfect for conference calls or binging podcasts. And unlike some of your other wireless options, Raycon earbuds are both stylish and discreet. There are no dangling wires or stems to distract anybody during video calls. You've heard me talk about how the company was co-founded by Ray J and celebrities like Snoop Dogg, Cardi B, J.R. Smith. They're all obsessed with Raycons. Pick up a pair and see what all the hype is all about. Now it's time to get the latest and greatest from Raycon. Get 15% off your order at buyraycon.com/Rome. These earbuds are amazing. Find out for yourself. Go to buyraycon.com/Rome and get 15% off. Buyraycon.com/Rome. Alex Mack is my guest, for sure. Now, I mentioned off the top, and you said you were kind of a starstruck, but earlier this spring, you were named to the 2010s All-Decade Team. That's an amazing honor. What does the honor represent to you? How does that feel?
It was a pretty good honor. I woke up in the morning and got a heads up, and I don't think when I heard the news, I quite realized the impact of that and what it actually meant. And so since that time, it's gotten a lot of attention, and it's been a real big honor. But it's just kind of supports everything I've tried to do my whole career, which is be the absolute best player I can be and just put year after year of, you know, good quality tape on film. And to be rewarded with that honor and to be recognized has been really, really nice, really reaffirming for the hard work you put in. Because being good at football is boring. It is a lot of time spent around the facility, working on your body, watching film, taking care of the little things, and it's nice to be rewarded for that.
I love that line. Being good at football is boring. It's a lot of work. So Joe Thomas is also a member of that team, and you've gone out of your way to praise him and thank him for the role that he played in your career. What did you learn from playing with him?
Joe is a great teammate. Not only is he a super good human just to have around in your life, he's also an incredible player. And to have that role model when I showed up, another young player, he was 2 years in front of me. And so to have this other young player who's already successful to kind of look at, mold after, kind of learn from was really valuable. A lot of good lessons early in the career, just a great friend and human. So just to go through a lot of tough years in Cleveland and have such a upbeat, nice guy who works hard every day to kind of support what you're trying to do yourself was really valuable. So Joe's a great friend of mine, and I owe him the world.
I'm talking to a three-time All-Pro, a six-time Pro Bowler, a center for the Atlanta Falcons. He's a member of the 2010s All-Decade Team. You know, the funny thing about him, Alex, he likes to say that you knew absolutely nothing about the NFL and even sports when you arrived in the NFL because you grew up in a family that didn't watch sports. Is there any truth to that, or is that just a gross exaggeration?
It's not that big of an exaggeration. I knew, like, what the sport of football was, but beyond that, not a whole lot more. My college friends used to play the game of just, like, who's this guy? And I'd have to, like, try to name the position, and I was just terrible. I never really watched sport. I loved playing it. I wholly support it. But I would never I grew up in Santa Barbara, so there wasn't, like, a local sports team that was nearby that I would go to games or anything. I'd watch the local high school growing up, and then once I got the high school ball, I started watching some of the, like, the nearby colleges, and then I was in the NFL by the time I started watching the NFL.
Yeah, obviously, Alex, I love that part of your story, too, because I went to UC Santa Barbara. I got my career start in Santa Barbara. You went to San Marcos High School in Santa Barbara.
Three birds.
Yeah, man, you touched on this. So, like, what was life like for you growing up in the 805 in Santa Barbara?
I mean, it was paradise, which is hard to complain about. I don't think I wore jeans until I got to Cal.
Right.
Like, just shorts every day, beautiful weather, maybe have a sweatshirt. Just wonderful place to live. Free birds, burritos, and super cucas, just living the life.
You might not find a better burrito than you can get at Free Birds. We're talking Alex Mack. I had Trey Turner on the show a few weeks back. We talked about Marshall Yanda and how he reshaped his body just months after retiring. It's amazing to look at that guy. What do you make of how he's reinvented himself and his body completely and to do it as quickly as he has?
Yeah, Yanda, great guy. I've been able to meet him at a couple of Pro Bowls, and he's just a super person. But I saw a picture of him, and it was like 2 months later or something. That is crazy. He's setting the bar really high for all us linemen for when we retire. Joe, too, is in the same category. It was like 2 months after he retired, he had a six-pack. It's not fair. Tried my whole life for that.
I mean, it's amazing. Like, Turner made the point, Alex, that it's not as easy as some people think to keep the good weight on as an offensive lineman. So what's it like for you? I mean, do you have to grind and work to maintain that weight, or is it relatively easy?
That's the scary part. It's relatively easy. So when it's all said and done, I have to hang up the cleats. It's going to be a real change of lifestyle for trying to slim down and get to a healthier weight. Hopefully, just, you know, a small change in the diet and not quite as heavy squat will take me a good bit there. But I'm looking for a big challenge in life. And I think it's tough when people retire. You know, I don't know when that's going to happen for me, but just down the road, having the lifestyle change and trying to change the body and losing the locker room. Like, I've talked to a lot of former teammates about just it's a tough transition sometimes.
What do you think? What's your biggest concern about that? I mean, you're not done yet, but you'll address that when the time comes. What's your biggest concern about retirement and what that change in life is going to be like?
Deciding what I want to do with my life will be tough. I mean, I've kind of just always played football, so it's been really easy to just do what is kind of asked of me and kind of follow what the team wants and be the best player. And all of a sudden to just give up what I've done for my whole life is going to be tough. To find a new identity of who am I? Am I an athlete? Am I just some guy? Like, what do I do with that? And then you lose a lot of friends. Like, automatically every year you go to a locker room and you have 60 guys that you have this common bond with. And to lose that is going to be tough. But
I think that's a really
when I retire, just 2 feet in, jump in and see what I want to do with my life and hopefully enjoy it.
There you go. I think that's a really candid response. Alex Mack is joining us. Listen, before you go, one of the topics that has been discussed a lot is the possibility of playing games without fans this fall. How much would that impact, for instance, how much would that impact you and the way you do your line calls?
Depends on what actually happens. If they have a microphone right in front of us from like the boom mic right in the center, I'm going to have to change my calls a lot just because I don't want the next defense I play to be able to know exactly what we're doing all the time. So trying to keep things secret, keep things confusing for the defense will be a key. Hopefully this doesn't happen and we have fans and it's loud and it's a fun time and everyone's normal. But I think everyone's kind of prepared for a different season to be had. It's going to be challenging. I mean, not looking forward to an empty, cold stadium, but it'll be easy to hear everybody. So that's the one benefit.
That's for sure. One last thought. Now, you have played the second most snaps among offensive players who aren't quarterbacks in the past decade. You know, the old saying that availability is your best ability. I know it's not easy to be out there every single play, and you've played through things like a fractured fibula. How much pride do you take in the fact that your teammates can count on you and they know that you'll be there when they need you?
I take a lot of pride in that. I think that's something really important for especially linemen. When you change that out, it's affecting a lot of the communication and the teamwork, and that's not easy to do. So the more you're able to be out there for your teammates, the more you can take care of your body. I think that's really valuable. Consistency is something that I think is really important for football in general, but especially linemen. If you have a bad play, you could end the quarterback season, and that kind of that almost ends your team season. So you have to be on every day, doing the right thing, dependable. And that's something I take very seriously. And it's not like I have some magic recipe. There's a lot of luck involved in terms of injuries. Just sometimes it happens, but doing everything you can to try to eliminate them is and cope with the things that do happen is really important.
9 days. Only 9 days until Smackoff 26. If you have not made your plans, do it. If you have not ripped your ticket yet, do that. If you have not RSVP'd yet, do it. Whatever you have not done yet in preparation for June 19th, do it. Do it now because it's getting late, and it's getting late quick. Now, 9 days, 7 shows. I have only 2 player profiles left. And let's just say I've saved the best for last. These final 2 guys have a combined 10 Smackoff titles. And what makes that stat even more impressive, their respective share of championship hardware is cut right down the middle. 5 for Sean the Cablin Asian, 5 for Brad and Corona. Next week, I'm going to get into the storylines heading into the event. But best believe, Sean and Brad fighting for a 6th ring is going to be the headliner. You know this. How could it not be? But before I do that, let me reset one of these goats right now. And let me start with this guy today.
Cablin Asian, the friendly ghost, the friendliest ghost you know. Skin horribly bright, pasty white. Cablin Asian, the friendly ghost.
I mean, even the BIC doesn't have his own song. Willie and KC never gave the BIC that kind of treatment. Sing it, Willie.
Cablin Asian, the friendly ghost, the friendliest ghost you know. Skin horribly bright, pasty white. Cablin Asian, the friendly ghost.
Shawnee the Cablin Asian by way of H-Town. Check these numbers out. Check this for data. 11 smack-offs, 5 titles, 2 runner-ups, and the only caller to ever three-peat. If you want to talk about a dynasty, look no further than his half-decade stretch from 03 to 07.
Take that for data.
In those 5 years, Shawnee ripped 4 straps and the silver medal. It was as dominant a stretch as we have ever seen on the program. I Afraidy himself called Shawnee the Eldrick of the jungle, and he wasn't wrong. Basically, when Sean showed up, everybody else was just wasting their time. It was always Sean or the field, and Sean would take it. History matters around here. So with that in mind, check out a baby-faced Van Smack bringing on Sean for his first smack-off 22 years ago in 1998.
1998, 4th annual smack-off. Gotta keep this thing moving along. Biggest day of the year in the jungle. Hope you're keeping score at home. Hope you took the day off. All right, let's go to it. We go to the Cablin Asian, Sean in Houston.
Rome, it is a privilege to be included in the biggest radio extravaganza of the year. Now, you know, Rome, in my time as a jungle dweller, it's like going to school. I've learned a lot. I mean, just in the last year, I've learned things like all Utah callers have the personality of a dish rag. I've learned that there is a part of me that really does want to eat the other half of the sandwich. And I've learned that John Candy is alive and well and living in Youngstown under the alias Jay in Y-Town. Now, here in H-Town, Jim, smack has basically become our third professional sport. And the only downside as a smack runner that I see to it, the paychecks aren't quite as nice as, say, baseball or basketball. I mean, I've called this show dozens of times in the last year, and I have yet to get a W-2 from Premier Radio, and I have yet to find a 1040 form that has a place for me to claim Metrics nutrition packs and cartons of Aura Blast or DirecTV t-shirts as compensation.
That is insane. Like, none of that makes any sense to anybody listening right now. None of those references make any sense to anybody listening right now. How about that audio from 1998? How about a hyped-up, baby-faced Van Smack going right to Shawnee the Cablin Asian? Smack-off number 4. That is amazing. None of that. Did any of that make any sense to anybody not named me? But it doesn't matter. I love the Metrics blast. The point is, this guy has tape going back almost to the very beginning. And 1 year after that debut call, he was back to rip the first of five titles.
In this topsy-turvy world where the president can treat an intern like a blow-up doll while he's got Boris Yeltsin on speakerphone and still keep his job, where a team will guarantee Tony Martin a six-figure salary even if he goes to prison, there are two constants that I know, Jim. One, the only way that Shaq gets his name on both sides of the forum is with a can of spray paint and a ladder. And two, I know that from 11 to 3 Central Time every day, I'm going to be entertained. The influence of your show, frankly, Jim's been felt not only in your time slot, quite honestly, it's spilled over into the others. I mean, before your show came on down here, Jim, the typical call to the local afternoon show went something like, Kenny, first-time caller. I was wondering if Mike Hampton is a lefty or a righty, and I'll hang up and listen. Now, Jim, thanks to the jungle, the typical call to the local afternoon show goes something like, Kenny, first-time caller. I was wondering if Mike Hampton is a lefty or righty, and I'll hang up and listen. I'm out. Yeah, major improvement, Jim. The Knicks really get it down here.
Shawnee, a trailblazer. And at that time, he was so much better than the rest. So much better than the rest that he forced everybody else to elevate their game. I always ask you to make the show better. Sean did. And from that point on, he started to stack smack-offs. He won four more. He rode off into the sunset on the heels of the jungle's only three-peat. There's leaving as a champ, leaving a champ, and then leaving a back-to-back-to-back champ. That's what Sean did. Never to be heard from ever again. Or so we thought, because after 11 years, Sean reappeared on Stevie Carbone's call back in 2018 out of nowhere.
Since when did you need a SAG card to construct a smack-off call? Back when I was winning this thing, all I did was roll out of bed, pop a few Adderall, and jot some bullet points down on a piece of paper. Now apparently you have to arrange the family reunion to win this thing. Damn, Les, there's easier ways to win $5,000 or make $5,000. Donate a kidney, hold up a convenience store, insurance fraud, something. And Brad and Corona, hey, man, I'm looking at this list, and I see you've won three of these, I guess, which means two more smack-off wins, and maybe you, too, can be the Kendrick Perkins to Jim's LeBron James on the CBS Sports Radio Network, 6 to 10 Eastern Time, Sundays, clones. Tune in. Hey, Jim, just use my address in the CBS Sports Radio directory. You can send me my retroactive $25,000 there. Do the math, clones, five times. Love you, Jimmy. Out.
Make no mistake, that was the holy bleep moment of Smack-Off 24. Not only did it help Stevie Carbone come in second place, but it ushered in the full-on return of the Cablin Asian for Smack-Off 25 last year. The first Smack-Off in jungle history that would feature both Brad and Sean. So Smack-Off 25 goes Brad's way, moves him into a tie for most wins all time with Shawnee. But Shawnee taking fourth place after 12 years away was impressive. And now he has already said that he will be back next Friday. Frankly, I cannot freaking wait for more of this.
The champ is here.
Take, take, take. There's no magic formula. Somehow I think most of you think that the more you call the show, the better you get. Let me end the suspense right here. That's not the case. You're either wired to win this thing or you're not.
Bobby in Brooklyn. Where I come from, Bobo, we have a word for someone in New York City who speaks good English, okay? A visitor.
Who's the best-looking Van Gundy brother? By the way, if your brother looks like Ron Jeremy and you're considered the ugly one, maybe time to get that face transplant, Jeff. What happens to air traffic when Barry Bonds and Peter King happen to be in the same city? Does air travel just shut down there altogether?
Skip Bayless and that new feathered haircut. Holy flock of seagulls. Nice lettuce, Skipper. Masters champ Phil Mickelson, who took the timeless art of slump busting to a whole new level when he bypassed hopping on a heavy set gnarly babe and decided to go ahead, grow a rack, and actually become one himself.
Otis, my man, you're a pretty good caller already, but I gotta tell you, when you finally learn to speak English, dude, you're gonna be unstoppable. Willie and KC, you make Clay Aiken look like Vin Diesel, dude. I took a torch that was passed by my predecessors, names like Ditola and Iafrady and Ditola and Iafrady. What the hell is Eustace going to be able to teach NBA players, right? All he did was get drunk and lick a few co-eds. The average NBA player was doing that at like age 3. Just like the shout-out to all you tennis fans who are pissed because Anna Kournikova had to withdraw from Wimbledon because of a back injury this week. Look, the woman spends an inordinate amount of time on her back, okay? This is bound to happen sooner or later. Get over it.
My favorite part, though, Jim, about the XFL was all those commercials, you know, where they try to build the league around their so-called stars, you know, those extreme in-your-face type commercials, you know, Tommy Maddox. I can't wait to see McMahon start his own basketball league, you know, Bobby Hurley.
I hate people who say that Brian Cashman has the hardest job in sports. People think his job is hard because he looks like he has two chocolate-covered donuts around his eyes and because he has this perpetual look on his face like he just saw CeCe Sabathia getting out of the shower. I mean, Cashman's job is more unbearable than having to sit next to Digger Phelps for
2 hours a night. Reese Davis would probably beg to differ.
I got to read the article about Jay Stu in the Daily News this morning. I wanted to point out my favorite quote. It's amazing how little my college education has to do with this. Stu, you went to Fullerton. Of course your college education has little to do with your job. There's no spatula involved.
The jungle. It's fantastic. I love this game.
What, you thought that guy could just fluke his way to five rings? Five straps? Of course he's that good. You just forgot how good he was because he was gone for so long. But he's back. And he's back to get what was rightfully his. He wants his retroactive pay. Back when he was stacking them, what were we giving away? I don't even remember, like packages. Packages of nothing. Sunflower seeds. Planet of the Apes DVDs. I mean, for real. He is Ariel Helwani. Ariel, it's good to have you on. How are you?
Jim, great to be on again. Thank you. How are you?
I'm great. It's good to have you back. There's so much to cover. Listen, before we get into all the news from yesterday, Ariel, go back to UFC 250 if you don't mind. What do you make of Sean O'Malley and the way he delivered in his fight?
Oh, man. I'm a big Sean O'Malley guy. I think he's so much fun. He's got the look. He understands how to promote yourself. You know, in the Reebok era, which means once the UFC it's been hard for fighters to break through, to look different, to stand out, and he does a phenomenal job with that. He just gets it. He's got this big afro. He colored it all different colors for this particular fight. He's got the braids for the actual fight, and he just has a really fun style. Now this was his second finish in the span of 3 months. I think he's probably two or three fights away from being in that discussion for, you know, title contention. He says he's ready right now, as you know, as expected. He's a very confident young man. But yeah, what a finish, what a knockout, what a character. I love everything about him. I can't get enough of him.
I did too. I think the guy's a star. I absolutely love the guy. Now, on any other night, his knockout is the only knockout we'd be talking about, except Cody Garbrandt had that monster knockout shot at the end of the second round. What was your reaction when you saw that?
When I saw that, and especially the replays, I was like, man, that's 3.5 years of frustration coming out in one punch. Because here's a guy who in 2016 beat Dominic Cruz to win the UFC bantamweight title, and we all thought that he was going to be one of the, you know, the faces of the UFC. This incredibly good looking guy with a fun style, an interesting look, a unique look, and he just beat Cruz in a very one-sided fight, and it just looked like he had the world at his fingertips. And then all of a sudden he loses three straight and he gets knocked out, and it feels like he sort of lost himself. But he came back. This was his first win since December of 2016, and it was his opportunity to snap that three-fight losing streak, and he did so in a very emphatic fashion. So he's now been training with a new coach in New Jersey. Mark Henry is his name, great striking coach, and I think we saw some of their work come out in that fight, and then just like the ferocity and how he cocked that thing back and knocked out Rafael Sunset was just amazing. So good to have Cody back, and I like the new Teen Wolf haircut that he's sporting these days as well.
I thought the guy looked amazing. I thought the hand speed was still there. I thought that he was tactical. I thought that he was smart, and obviously we know he can still punch. So who's the best bantamweight right now in your mind?
Aljamain Sterling, because I'm not including Henry Cejudo because he retired, right? If we want to include Cejudo, I'll put him at the top of the list, but he retired and vacated the title. In my opinion, Aljamain Sterling is the uncrowned champion of the UFC. He's the king without a crown. That fight on Saturday against Corey Sandhagen should have been for the bantamweight title. And for whatever reason, they didn't make it for the bantamweight title. They're doing Petr Yan versus Jose Aldo July 11th. But I swear to God, Jim, if Aljamain Sterling isn't fighting for the belt next, if he isn't fighting the winner of that fight, and I suspect he will, then that will be a travesty. But yeah, right now, I'll say it's Aljamain Sterling because of the way he looked on Saturday against Corey Sandhagen.
Ariel Helwani is joining us. All right, so yesterday was a really busy day for UFC news. You had reported much of this on Monday night, so let's talk about the matchups for UFC 251 and the fact that Usman is going to fight Burns. What do you make of that matchup?
All right, so, you know, UFC 251 is a fun card, and I feel like I know where you're going with this question, and I'm happy that you teed me up that way because three title fights, always fun. Usman, great champion. Burns has been on fire. But I have to admit, I'm sad. I'm sad, Jim, because this isn't the fight that we were promised. This isn't the fight that we thought was going to happen. We thought it was going to be Jorge Masvidal against Kamaru Usman. And unfortunately, they couldn't come to terms on a deal. They had negotiation issues, and maybe it isn't the best time to go through negotiations like that in the midst of a pandemic. But hey, Jorge Masvidal has been in the game 18 years. This is his time to cash in. He finally gets a shot and fighting for the UFC title. And he's not just going to take any kind of deal. So I understand his perspective as well. And in the end, they went with Gilbert Burns, who was a lot cheaper. And it, again, in a vacuum, a fine fight, a great fight with a fine backstory as well. But we all wanted to see game bred against Usman for the belt. They have a bitter rivalry. They had a little melee at Super Bowl Media Row. I mean, this has just been brewing since November of last year. And I'm a little bummed that they couldn't come to terms. So, you know, like I said, it'll be fun July 11th, great fights. But to me, you know, there's a bit of a cloud hanging over it because the fight that we all wanted to see was Usman versus Masvidal.
I know exactly what you're talking about. In fact, I talked to Masvidal on Radio Row, Ariel, when that went down. And then when he left my set, I looked out of the corner of my eye and there he was talking to Usman. Oh. I'm like, damn, like this is legit. This is real. This is not for show. So then you've got Masvidal, and as you point out, he is holding back. He's not holding back when it comes to his criticism of the UFC. What do you think Dana and the UFC make of his recent tweets?
Well, I'm sure they don't like it. They don't like when people talk about the business openly like that, and they certainly don't like when people are confrontational and start, quote-unquote, exposing things. Dana's reply has been, hey, we're in the midst of a pandemic. You know, what are you guys talking about? And my fighters are all cooped up, and they're acting crazy. I don't know if you've been on social media and you look at Jorge Masvidal. Jorge Masvidal is not cooped up at home. The guy is out and about. He's training. He's not acting this way because of the pandemic. He's just about to fight for a world title, and he wants what he thinks he's owed. They were offering him originally less to fight Kamaru Usman for the actual belt than he fought Nate Diaz for in November. And he was like, how does that make sense? I'm fighting for a fake title, the BMF title in November, and you're offering me X amount. And then now that I get to fight for the undisputed title, you're offering me less. So eventually, at the 11th hour, they ended up offering him the same. But apparently, the damage had been done, and they were too far apart. And so they went with Gilbert Burns. And, you know, historically, Dana is the kind of guy who doesn't forget these sorts of things. But when you have leverage, you know, when you have star power, they'll do business with you. It's more on the back end that they'll not forget these sorts of things, and you'll be in bad standing with them. And so we'll see. You know, Masvidal should fight the winner of this fight. We'll see if they go back to him when this is all said and done, and maybe fans will be allowed, and maybe it'll be easier for the UFC to justify giving him a raise because they'll get gate revenue. But again, you know, I don't love the idea of, you know, okay, we got this guy, this is the guy, oh, you won't do it for whatever price we want you to do it, so now let's go to the cheaper guy. Like, that's not what the UFC was built on. The UFC was built on, we put the fights together that make sense, the fans want to see, we give it to the deserving guys, we're not boxing, right? Well, this was a little bit of an old-school boxing move, if you ask me.
Ariel Helwani is joining us. All right, so UFC 251, Ariel, is going to take place on Fight Island. What are your early impressions of Fight Island, and how do you think the fighters are going to respond to that experience?
I think Fight Island was a tremendous marketing ploy by the UFC. I mean, one of their best pieces of work ever from a promotional standpoint, because our imaginations ran wild. And I will be honest, I tried to temper people's expectations because I didn't think it was going to go down like everyone was saying it was going to go down. But Fight Island is such a catchy phrase and name. In the end, it's happening on Yas Island in Abu Dhabi. I've been to Yas Island, Jim, in Abu Dhabi. There's no palm trees and beaches and all that stuff. Like, none of that's going to happen here. It's the middle of the desert. And it's going to be like in this makeshift, almost like a hangar. There's not going to be any like waves crashing behind. There'll be no palm trees, none of that around the octagon. It's going to be in the middle of the night over there because they're going to try to cater, you know, to the audience here in North America. So the main card will start at 6 a.m. local time. Now, I'm not trying to be a negative Nancy here. I'm not trying to poo-poo. This is great for the UFC because now you can have international fighters fight on these cards. As long as you're holding events in America, you can't have the international fighters come in. So this is huge for them, and that's why they're doing July 11th, July 15th, July 18th, and July 25th to get all those international fighters fights. So that's massive for them. But the idea that it was going to take place in this very exotic locale with, you know, bikinis and palm trees and beaches and sand, it's not going to happen. It was never going to happen that way, but everyone just kind of went a little crazy with it. So here we are. It's Fight Island, a.k.a. Yas Island, in Abu Dhabi.
Yeah, so you're exactly right, Ariel, because when I close my eyes and I think about Fight Island, that's exactly what I see, and I want to continue to see that, but I see. I see what you're. I see where you're going with this because I've never been there and you have. I mean, it's amazing. You and I could keep doing this. There is so much to talk about. What about the announcement of UFC 252, where we have our trilogy fight now between Stipe and your broadcasting partner DC? What is your sense as to how Daniel Cormier is feeling about that fight now?
Well, and you're right. You know, I feel so blessed to cover this wacky sport at times, because while everyone is talking about revenue sharing and all this other craziness, we're talking about like fight drama, which is, I think, why we all love sports, right? You know, the drama of the back and forth and the rivalries and whatnot. So here's another example. August 15th, UFC 252, DC and Stipe 3. The first two fights were amazing. We'll get the third fight. And DC says, win or lose, this is my retirement fight. I'm done after this. Now, I keep saying to him, yeah, what if you win in 30 seconds, right? Flash knockout, and they offer you John Jones at heavyweight, trilogy fight. You can retire beating John Jones. Are you really going to turn that down? He says yes. He's 41. He says, I've had enough. But, you know, remains to be seen. And you know what's so fascinating about this, Jim? You can actually come up with a scenario that isn't too far-fetched, where this is actually the last fight for both guys involved in this fight. Like, I could see a scenario where DC wins, retires, Stipe loses, retires as well. He's 38. He works as a fireman in Ohio. He wants to raise a family. I can actually foresee a scenario where you have a title fight here for the heavyweight title, and both guys are done after this one, which is extremely unique. So I think DC is going to give it his all. He actually built himself his own gym at his home, his own sauna. Like, he's taking this very seriously. Obviously, it's hard to train these days in California, but he feels like this is the end of my athletic career. It started, you know, back in the day as a high school wrestler, back in the day at Oklahoma State, then the Olympics, Strikeforce, UFC. This is the end. I'm going to give him my all, and hopefully I walk out a winner.
We're talking to Ariel Helwani. One last thought. What about Conor McGregor? Of course, over the weekend, Ariel, he tweeted that he was retiring for the third time, and you communicated with him after that announcement. What is your sense as to his mood?
Yeah, see, another crazy story. So, yeah, so I two things. I wish that his timing was a little bit different because, you know, Amanda Nunes is walking out of the cage, and then you drop that tweet, and everyone's like, hey, you're trying to steal her shine. And I don't think he was trying to steal her shine. And I also wish he didn't use the R word, the retirement word, right? Because that has clouded everyone's opinion of this situation. If you actually read what he said to me, what I wrote, it's a lot different than the other two times that he retired via Twitter. The other two times he just put out a tweet and walked away, and we didn't actually get an explanation. This time, at least he explained his thoughts, which I thought was very valuable. He's basically saying, I'm frustrated. I had a horrible 2019. I told you all I wanted to fight three times in 2020. I told you all that I'm healthy, that I'm going to stay on the straight and narrow. I've been doing great things in my community. I've been donating to hospitals in Ireland, visiting children's hospitals, all that stuff. I'm staying out of trouble. I looked amazing in my first fight back in January against Donald Cerrone. And now you guys are saying you can't get me a fight. Now you guys are saying that I have to wait for the winner of Gaethje versus Khabib, and that's probably going to happen, what, in September? And then, you know, the winner of that fight's going to be ready to go in December or January? This isn't fair. I want to fight. I don't care. Just get me a fight. Now, the UFC is a little hesitant because they stand to lose a lot of money if they put on a Conor fight now, because his gates generate usually around $15 to $18 million. But Conor's saying, put me on now. We'll sell a bunch of pay-per-views, and everyone will be happy. And they're saying that now is not the right time. And so he's frustrated, he's tired, and he's like, you know what, I'm out of here. Do I suspect he'll fight again at some point? Yes. I just wonder how they figure this out. And by the way, we just talked about a guy who's available who's a pretty big star. You see where I'm going with this?
I do.
Do Masvidal versus Conor, right?
God, that'd be amazing. That'd be such an amazing fight. How would you handicap that fight?
Well, Masvidal's a really big 170-pounder, and Conor, you know, Conor prides himself on being able to hang with the 170-pounders. It would not go to the ground. I would say that there will not be a single takedown attempt. I suspect that they'll both stand and trade the entire time. It'll be more like a boxing match, maybe like a boxing/kickboxing match. And honestly, I would say that one would end in a finish. Someone will knock someone else out. Now, Jim, you may know this, and you've been privy to this in the past. Athletes, in particular combat sports athletes, they're very sensitive people. And if you pick against them, they will hold that grudge until the end of time. And so if you're looking for me to make a prediction right now, I will not do so, because I want to talk to both guys and I have a good relationship with them. And I would hate to ruin that relationship when they say, I heard you on the Jim Rome show and you said that I was going to get knocked out. We're done. Because guess what? That would happen almost verbatim. it's not worth it.
No, it does, Ariel. I, with respect to what you're saying, I've been there. I've lived that. I continue to live that. That's a real thing. I've had guys that I've had an amazing relationship with. They've come on the show for years and years and years and years. And then I'll say just that. You know what? I think that's not going to go well for them. And then they're like, I'll never talk to you ever again. I'm like, how'd that get so personal? Anyway, yeah. since you won't say it and I respect it and I know where you're going, I like Jorge in that fight. In the event they fight, I like Jorge in that fight. But Connor's not doing the show anyway ever again. I miss Connor.
He had him back in the day, right?
Oh, my. Yeah, he was amazing back in the day. In fact, I stand by this. I've never seen a greater showman than Connor McGregor. Pound for pound, nobody can promote and nobody can give you the kind of show that he can. But as you might imagine, he's kind of burned out on that whole thing. Ariel Helwani. Yeah. He's a journalist for ESPN. I ran down the list of shows that he's hosting. He is a good friend of the program, and I agree with you. It is so good to have content and things to talk about. Ariel, well done. Thanks for breaking that down for us.
Anytime, Jim. And by the way, I'm about to talk to your friend, Chael P. Sonnen, and I'll say one of the greatest moments in your show's history was when you pressed him on the comments about Lance Armstrong, and he said it sounded like a Mexican guy. So I was reminiscing about that as I was preparing to talk to Chael and watching the Lance doc. That was a phenomenal, historic moment. I urge anyone out there to look it up. I love that moment.
In the meantime, we are joined right now by a tight end for the Buffalo Bills. Last season, he had 28 receptions, 388 yards, a couple of touchdowns. The first Bills tight end to have a rushing attempt in more than a decade. He was the 96th pick in last year's draft out of Ole Miss. We are joined now by Dawson Knox. Dawson, it's great to have you on. Let me first ask you, it's your first offseason as an NFL player. It's been an incredibly unusual offseason. So how are you and everybody around you doing right now?
Yeah, so it's definitely been a weird offseason. You know, thankfully I've still been able to see some teammates here and there. But, I mean, it's just all about finding a way to work out, to stay in shape, to be ready whenever we got to come back. So, thankfully, like, even through all this weird COVID stuff, I've still known, you know, a couple people that have gyms that have stayed open because they're considered essential. So, I've still been able to work out and have some good facilities and been able to work out with a couple dudes that are also on different NFL teams that are around Nashville with me. So we've just been, you know, trying to find the best way to stay in shape.
Dawson Knox joining us. You jump right to my second point. I was going to say that I had Atlanta Falcons center Alex Mack on the show in the first hour, and we were talking about how he went out immediately as a vet, and he bought a bunch of weights. He made a serious home gym. You just mentioned that there's some guys around town and some gyms that stayed open for you. Are you getting any of this work done at home? Do you have a setup at home?
Yeah, so thankfully I have a little place downtown in Nashville. It's kind of in a big building, so the weight room has been open for the most part. There was about a month where it went where it was closed, which was unfortunate. But it's really nice. It's back open now. It's nice just to have something right down the hall that I can use. And also my parents' house, they live about 20 minutes south. They have a pretty decent home gym. So if I'm ever at home, you know, seeing them at all, I'll be able to get in some work. And they actually have a Peloton too. I got it from my mom for Christmas, so I've been able to jump on that some, which has been nice.
It does. I've got one too, and it's amazing to me how many athletes are using it. I got mine a couple of years back. I love it, and I used it anyway, but then when this whole thing came down and I couldn't get to the gym, I fell in love with it all over again. What are those rides like for you? Do you do 30 minutes, 45 minutes? How do you approach the Peloton?
Oh yeah, that thing's incredible. I love it. It's so nice, too, because you're not really pounding on your joints as much as
right.
You would be if you were sprinting or doing a bunch of cutting and stuff. But typically, I do the 30-minute high-intensity interval ones. You know, sometimes I'll do a 20-minute one if it's kind of a, you know, harder day in the weight room. But the longest I've done is 45. I like, you know, doing some of the country music rides. I kind of switch it up, and I'll do some hip-hop rides. But I kind of like just bouncing around and trying out different things. But I'd say it's probably the hit ones that I go back to the most.
Yeah, I like the hit ride too. That's tough. Dawson Knox is joining us. Now, it did not take you long last year to have an iconic moment. Fourth quarter, week three, game against Cincinnati. You're trailing 17-14. You catch a pass. You proceed to truck one defender after another. You turn that into a 49-yard gain. The crowd's going crazy. Your teammates are going crazy. When you think back on that play, what sticks out the most to you?
Yeah, so That was like, I think, the third or fourth play in that drive, and we were in the 2-minute offense. So I was honestly kind of gassed already. And then after making that, you know, long run, I just remember getting up super pumped, but also super winded, trying to catch my breath. So dudes were, you know, jumping on me, celebrating, and I was trying to get mentally prepared for the next play. But it was fun, just you know, being able to make a play for the team coming down the stretch.
I know you're playing it down. It was savage. It was an amazing play. And you know, when I see that play, and then if we go back even a little earlier, this is kind of interesting. You played your high school ball at Brentwood Academy in Tennessee. Your father told The Athletic that for a while you were, quote, just medium sized, pudgy, a quick kid that was very determined, very aggressive, and did the right things. I don't know, man. Watching you play right now, it's hard to imagine that you were a medium-sized, pudgy kid. I mean, what were you like as an athlete growing up?
Yeah, so like my earliest years of playing football, I felt like I was able to, you know, stick out a little bit. I was pretty fast. I was actually playing running back when I first started in like fifth and sixth grade. Which was really fun, you know, just getting the ball every other play. Cause you know, at that age, they don't throw a whole lot, but, and then slowly everybody just started kind of outgrowing me, you know, hitting puberty. And I was real late. I was a late bloomer. I really didn't start hitting that growth spurt until junior year. Going into my junior season in high school, I think I still had the roster. I think I was listed at like 5'10", 168. I was playing backup quarterback, and I played a little bit of receiver. I was probably the fifth or sixth receiver to go in the game. So I had very, very limited film. And then finally going into my senior year, I had grown. I was about, you know, 6'3", 210, you know, really feeling good, really excited to finally get out there and compete because I felt like I was, you know, finally caught up growth-wise and even surpassing a lot of people. And then very first game my senior year, I dislocated my ankle, which set me out for the whole season. So I had, you know, like 2 quarters of film basically on my huddle or whatever, a couple scrimmage plays here and there, but didn't really have any scholarship offers and ended up walking on to Ole Miss.
We're talking to Dawson Knox. I mean, that's incredible the way you lay that out. You finally, I mean, you catch up, you get your opportunity, you're 6'3", you're 210. Things are about to get rolling, and then you suffer that injury. However, Hugh Freeze had seen you in that game. He told you he had a preferred walk-on spot for you at Ole Miss. What did that mean to you at that time, and what was your mindset then when you went to college?
Yeah, so I was very thankful to have a couple different preferred walk-on opportunities at a couple different SEC schools. And it actually turns out I was supposed to visit Tennessee, the University of Tennessee, the weekend that I ended up visiting Ole Miss, because I think someone at Tennessee fell through and they had to reschedule. So I ended up visiting Ole Miss. I didn't know anything about Ole Miss. No family members ever went there. Oh, it's actually funny. I went there once my sophomore year with a friend who was a big Texas fan because Texas was playing at Ole Miss. And I was wearing Texas stuff for that game. But that was my first exposure to Ole Miss. But after I visited, I kind of just fell in love with the coaches and the facilities. The campus was beautiful. And it just felt like home for me. And I was very happy with my decision after I got there and you know, started competing a little bit.
We're talking to Dawson Knox for a few more moments. You know, I asked this of every one of your teammates, but I've got to ask you too then. What was it like living and playing in Buffalo last season?
Oh, very, very different than everything I was used to. Obviously, I've grown up in the South, haven't lived anywhere else besides Nashville, lived at Ole Miss, you know, for 4 years, you know, where the weather is super hot, you know, but going up to Buffalo, I actually love playing in the cold because, you know, I'm not cramping up at halftime. You're not sweating as much. Like, the fans are unlike anything I've ever seen in my life. Like, it's unbelievable. It's so fun to play for. That's why I'm just praying that they allow fans in the stands this year because the type of energy that, you know, the mafia brings to games, it just makes it so fun to play for. But it was really fun. You know, I lived in Hamburg last season. I just moved downtown. And it's been really fun starting to, you know, kind of really get used to the culture up there. And Like, I've had more wings in the last year than I've had in my entire life, and they've all been good. So I've really enjoyed it so far.
I love that town. Great town. Bills Mafia is amazing. So when you get a taste of the playoffs the way you did, how much does that motivate you to want to get back there and advance?
Oh, I think everybody was kind of left with a bitter taste in their mouth after that loss. But I think that's going to be the biggest motivating factor to get us back to where we want to be next year or this season coming up, because I don't think you can learn nearly as much from a win as you can from a loss. So I think that's kind of the behind-the-scenes factor that's going to really, you know, push guys harder this offseason and kind of show – you know, the hard work will pay off, and then once we get there, we got to, you know, make the most of our opportunity.
Dawson, one quick thing. We mentioned family. As some people know, you've got four siblings, including two adopted younger brothers, Isaiah and Nate. What was life like growing up in your house, and how much do your siblings mean to you?
Yeah, so I've always been a huge family-oriented person. I love seeing, you know, seeing my siblings every chance I get. I try to see them every day now that I'm, you know, here for a little bit longer. My parents are incredible. They've been together. They started dating when they were sophomores in high school and actually went to the same high school I did. And my two adopted little brothers, we adopted them about 8 years ago. So they've been such an incredible part of our family. I know for a fact I'm going to want to adopt one day. I just can't, you know, see what our family would be like without them. And they've been huge blessings for us as well. But yeah, it's so fun getting to go home playing Xbox with them. They're all about, you know, Minecraft right now and superhero movies and action figures and Star Wars all over the place. So it's kind of fun being able to kind of relive my childhood a little bit through them. So it's been really cool.
Jeff in Richmond, my man Jeff, how are you?
Jim, thanks for the vine and thanks for the time. And Jim, if you'll indulge me, Jim, for a brief moment. I want to give a shout-out, Jim, to the millions, Jim, and the millions of my peeps across the fruited plain, Jim, and say, Jim, that finally, Jim, the dirtiest player in the game, Jeff from Richmond, has come back to the Jim Rome Show. By the way, Jim, if you think Arizona Cardinals head coach Cliff Kingsbury has a fresh crib, you should see my setup here in the great Commonwealth of Virginia, Jim, the 804. Jim, how tired and played is it to see 86-year-old Lizard Larry King, flesh on a stick, still pimping product on cable TV? Jim, my man's pimping vitamins, prostate meds, credit reporting services. Remember back in the day, Jim, when the Lizard, the hunchback of CNN, was actually considered fairly fresh and hip? You remember those days, Jim? New York, hello. Chicago, hello. Sacramento, hello. Memo to Lizard Larry King. Flesh on a stick. Hey, Lizard, maybe if you spend a little less time pimping product and a little more time with your family, maybe you wouldn't have cycled through 8 marriages, Jim. That's right, 8. And his latest wife, Shawnee, who's 30 years his junior, was actually quoted in TMZ, and I quote, Larry was actually a pretty good husband early on. He kept his mouth shut and his checkbook open. And by the way, Jim, Shawnee had a nickname for the Lizard, and it wasn't Honey Bear, Sweetie Pie, Jim. It was Big Old Cash Machine. Finally, Jim, very quickly, for 20-plus years, Jim, Jeff from Richmond's been swinging from a jungle vine. And I'm proud to say, Jim, that we're friends, we're colleagues, and we're business partners for 20-plus years. I want to get real with you for a minute, Jim, because on September 11th, 2001, the United States suffered a terrorist attack that changed the world forever. And, Jim, in the days and weeks and months that followed, you helped us get through those dark days, Jim. You helped us laugh a little and smile a little. Then, Jim, fast forward, 2008, 2009, the financial crisis. Jim, once again, your program helped us regain a sense of normalcy and helped us move forward. Now today, Jim, here we are, Jim. Here we are, Jim. Your lettuce is flowing. You have no face cake slapped on your grill. You're stepping up to the plate each and every day, not only in the face of the COVID-19 pandemic, but now, Jim, the George Floyd tragedy. Jim, you're leading from the front. You're doing it with dignity and grace and humility. The bottom line is this, Jim. I have never, Jim, and I mean ever, seen a more essential frontline worker, Jim, than James Philip Rome. So, Jim, as a result, we have your back for Smack Off 26, Jim. All the heavy hitters and Matt from L.A. are coming out to play, Jim. On June the 19th, Jim, all the five-tool ball players and Jerome from Houston are coming out to play, Jim. On June the 19th, all the legitimate jungle legends and Mark from Boston are coming out to play, Jim. And on June the 19th, all the sports talk savages and Chris from Toronto are coming out to play, Jim. In closing, a la Baker Mayfield, Jim, Jeff from Richmond is symbolically planting the Commonwealth of Virginia flag in your studio. I will take my respect on June the 19th, Jim. Jim, Jeff from Richmond's coming to the Smack Off. Hell's coming with me. The only question I want to ask the morally bankrupt clones is this, Jim. Who wants to walk with Jeff from Richmond? Jim, thank you for your time. Aloha means goodbye. War Commonwealth of Virginia. War number 45, Donald from Manhattan. War Beaks from Studio City, completing the weight loss challenge, but still tipping the scales at well over $3 bills. War Mr. Automatic J. Stu, without the nicks and cuts of a blade. And until next time, Jim, good night now!
Welcome back, champ. Mark in Boston is back. Mark, what's going on?
Hey, Jimmy, this call, much like my physique, is going to be about half the size of Jeff in Richmond. Hey, who wants to walk with Jeff in Richmond? Buddy, you really should not brag about something you can't do. I mean, be honest. How long ago did the type 2 beatus take those feet? Is that why you were sitting in that family pic? The one that looked like a bunch of kids gathered around a corpse like it was weekend at morbidly obese Bernie's? Jim, that's one of the drawbacks of this show going to television. It was a lot easier to think that Jeff in Richmond was in a palatial estate when we also didn't have visual confirmation that in order to leave, he had to be airlifted out of the roof. When your wife said go to the gym, she didn't mean call Jim Rome. I can see why you made the mistake, though. You got out of breath so bad there at the end, your Apple Watch probably gave you a full workout. So congrats, dude. 4,000 calls to go. Jeff, Larry King is in his mid-90s, is melting internally and externally. He looks and sounds like the Crypt Keeper and somehow has a better body than you. What's worse? Larry King's 8 marriages or 8 bypass surgeries? Dude, you spend so much time under the knife, your cardiologist calls you Steak in Richmond. Did you war Beaks in Studio City because he's your long-lost, large adult son, and you just want him to come home? Beaks, go home. Daddy misses you. I mean, the resemblance is certainly similar. I never want to see both of you with your shirt off ever again. You both abandoned your neck around 09. You both dumped dish soap in a hot tub for your weekly bath while your wife tosses you fish as a reward. I would say keep my name out of your mouth, but judging by the size of it, you could fit the entire field in your mouth and have room to spare. See you in 9 days, Jimmy.
Damn. Mark in Boston. See you in 9 days. Actually, I didn't hear anything after you hit him with that type 2 beatus blast. Dan in Denver jumping back into the fray. Hey, Dan, how are you?
I'm good, Jim. I like the profile for Sean the Cablinasian. I noticed you left the name of his current show out, Payne and Pendergast. Shawnee, quick question. Is Payne your co-host or what your listeners feel? Jim, we got Shawnee, Jeff, and Caleb in the field. Are we hosting a smack-off or building an NFL O-line? Jim, Sean the Cablinasian is so fat, he set up a GoFundMe during the crisis just to support his eating habits. A lot thought it would be embarrassing for Sean to return to the jungle after all that crap he talked and eat crow, but I'm guessing he loved eating every morsel of it And Romy, I heard Jeff in Southfield take a run at me Friday. Hey, Jeff, it's supposed to be your name followed by your city, township, or area code in which you reside, not your name followed by your exact location. Jeff in a field south. Although I guess that plays for Matt and Van, too. Jimmy, this guy's delivery is so slow, Amazon tried to refund its shipping. Jeff in Southfield is so dirty and poor, the only ring he could afford to give his wife was ringworm. But speaking of fields, Jimmy, Friday, June 19th, I'm going to make my bed in the Smack-Off field. And, Jimmy, I'm a bedwetter.
Good night now!